This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we're going to talk to New York Times bestselling author, James Rollins, and his new book, which is very interesting. It's called The Seventh Plague, and I think it's his 33rd book. Is that correct, James?
As mind-boggling as that is to me, yes, that's true.
33
The Sigma novels and 33 books total.
How many Sigma novels? This is number 12?
This is number 12, yep.
Wow. I know I've read, I don't think I've read them all, but I know I've read a fair number of them. I every one I read, I just enjoy so much. I mean, it's...
Well, thank you.
But I do, you know, there's so much in these books. I feel like it's like I'm taking a course or something.
Well, hopefully it's not quite as torturous as that.
Well, I mean, there's just so much information is what I'm trying to say, I guess.
Right. I mean, I definitely like to build a roller coaster ride and hopefully keep people turning pages late into the night. But, you know, hopefully after I always think thrillers work best if they're little mirrors of what's going on in the real world, so that hopefully when you turn that last page and you close that last book, I've left you hope with a little bit of something to think about. You know, at the end of each book, I have the what's true and what's not section where I pull aside the curtain and strip away the fiction from the fact. And so if anybody has any question whether certain parts of the story are true or not, you're going to find out at the end. Plus, if you have any interest in any of the topics, hopefully I've left you a few breadcrumbs to follow in case there's any interest.
Now, this interesting bug on the cover with the blood dripping, it's such an interesting, it catches your eye so easily.
The art department at HarperCollins is fantastic, and they're probably one of the rare authors where they oftentimes will ask my input, though I had this all them. They came up with a brilliant concept for the cover. But, you know, it's sort of fascinating that, you know, for the cover for my paperback novel to The Sixth Extinction of the couple Sigma books prior to this, I had gotten a little image from a fan, from a reader. And it was such a cool image. I forwarded it to the art department and said, hey, this would make a cool image for the paperback cover of the book for The Sixth Extinction. And they ended up using it. So that's sort of cool that, that social media, is a great way of to connect author to reader. And oftentimes I'll get, great little tidbits for story ideas, via social media. But, in this case, it actually helped design a cover.
Wow, that surprises me. Because every time I talk to an author, they always say, well, I don't really have any say. They sometimes have a say with the cover, but a lot of times they say, well, they do whatever they put on the cover, they want to put on the cover. You know, they're the ones selling the book. So they like, well, you wrote the book, don't you have to? I always wonder how much say an author has in what a cover is going to look like.
Even my position, I can make suggestions, but ultimately, and I understand where they're coming from in that, the cover is a primary marketing tool, and, I don't have a marketing degree, so I'm assuming that hopefully somebody with a better, track record and experience for what might, attract that eye, what has, the stickability factor, whatever that marketing term is, that they're probably better suited than I am.
Exactly. So have you ever seen one of your covers? I mean, did they show you right away that you hated, that you thought, oh, I hope they don't use that cover?
Yes, and in that respect, if I feel very strongly about a cover...
Well, it has happened.
I had an ability to be able to, a couple of times, I don't like that at all. And they have gone back to the drawing board and gone from scratch. So they at least given me that much leeway to at least have veto power.
What I like about your books is the characters all the times. I love the plots too, but the characters are what really make me, when I read the books, I think to myself, I miss these characters. I wish, because when you don't read them for a while, you just miss them. You're like, I wonder what they're up to now. It's sort of like we're watching family members that we haven't seen in a while,
Right. when it comes to writing, I feel the same way. Is, you know, at this point, I've written, you know, Commander Greg Pierce has been in all 12 Sigma books, and I would swear that I wouldn't be surprised if I walked around a corner and there he is. You know, so fully formed in my head after writing, you know, 12 large volumes about him. And, you know, I think it's nice having, you know, at this point with 33 novels, I think I've tried to destroy the world 33 times. I still have a couple more ways in my back pocket. But, you know, yes, that always makes for a good thrilling read to have a global threat. But, you know, to me, it's always what I think works best for, you know, getting that reader's heart beating stronger is when that threat's brought to a more personal level. And not just a big global threat, but when there's a personal stake involved with the characters. And but again, you're not going to care as a reader if I don't establish that bond between the reader and that character, and establish it well. So when I dangle that character over a cliff, the readers are going to care whether or not that rope breaks or they slip off of that cliff. If you don't care about the characters, you're not going to be that invested in that outcome.
Absolutely.
So again, it's, you know, one of the big factors, I think, for any writer for that matter, really needs to establish that sympathy between the character and that reader.
Every time I read one of your books, I think to myself, this man must be a genius to have all this stuff in his head.
That's not the case.
But I mean, there's so much in these books, and I think, how do you do this? How do you do this for 33 books? You have created these stories that are so plausible and so interesting, and I think, well, how do you do that? And how do you not repeat yourself after a while? I mean, you ever have a friend where you just keep talking, and all of a sudden you realize, you know, I said that to them before. So you do. We do tend to repeat ourselves sometimes without even realizing it. So how do you do that? How do you keep it original with every book? That's so hard.
Well, I grew up reading, and a big influence in my books is a series of pulp novels from the 30s and 40s that were reprinted as Bantam paperbacks in the 1970s. It's the, excuse me, the old Doc Savage novels. And it's 181 Doc Savage novels. So
oh, my God.
It's mostly written by one guy named Lester Dent, but there's a few other authors under the pseudonym Kenneth Robeson that also wrote those books. But they managed to write 181 different threats to the world. So it can be done, eh? And I read some of the stories about Lester Dent and things that he's written, the author of these books. And one thing that sort of stuck with me was that he wrote at one point, said, you know, when you're writing novels, make sure you don't kill your characters the same way twice. And so he was a big proponent of, you know, don't just shoot everybody all the time. You know, a good garroting is always refreshing. So, you know, that's been an adage that's sort of always been in the back of my head is you know, not to repeat myself, is to stretch to make sure that action set piece is unique. It's a challenge, but it's again, you know, I think I've got to be excited about it. You know, readers, I think, have a good nose for when a writer is somewhat bored with their own writing or for a writer feels stale with their writing. So my goal is if I'm not excited about that action set piece, I don't think my reader is going to be either. Sometimes that, you know, takes a little, you know, fine tuning and fine, you know, a bit of tooling to make that that action scene, you know, really, really sing.
The reason I'm laughing is I'm thinking about you tend to like to take body parts off sometimes, like a finger or I'm laughing about I can just see you spinning a wheel there. What body part should I cut off today?
there's one character named Monk, which actually the name Monk came from the Doc Savage novels. Doc
really?
Was surrounded by a series of sidekicks. He had like four or five people that worked alongside him, and one of them was Monk. So that's where Monk's name come from, and I'm notorious for slowly trimming away pieces of Monk's anatomy. He's been winnowing away very slowly. People are like, quit torturing Monk.
I'd like to see a picture of him. The way he is today.
On one leg.
Yeah, exactly. I'm thinking of, you know, and that's such a classic way to make a character more real, is to have something, to have them have some kind of infirmity where they're not. And we all, you know, know the different characters in literature that have lost part of their anatomy, and it just makes them more interesting, I think, for some reason. But You know, you can only imagine. I was reading a book last night where somebody bit somebody's ear, and I'm thinking, what would that feel like? And I'm reading it, I'm thinking, ooh, how would that feel?
I was wondering what that would feel like for the one that was doing the biting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Ooh, ooh, it gives me the creeps. I mean, to think about it, the boxer that did it too, and I always thought that was bizarre, but I mean, you wonder how animalistic people can be, you know, and it makes you cringe to think that somebody could do that to another person, but
they can, and they do.
Yeah, exactly. So, this is book number 33. Now, you write some by yourself and some with Rebecca Cantrell, is that her name?
Yeah, I've done 3 books with Rebecca and 2 books with Grant. It's sort of novel. I mean, I've generally done 2 books a year, and I've done like 1 Sigma book recently a year, and then something else.
So how do you decide what to do next? I mean, where does it come from? I mean,
it usually comes just from whatever seems to, again, like I said, writing from the point of passion, whatever sort of idea gets sort of stuck in my head. And like I'd never done a collaborative piece of work, and I had this, you know, idea for sort of a modern take on the vampiric type of story dealing with history and science. And I've known Rebecca since before she was ever published. She had taken a writing class that I was teaching on the Maui Writers Conference, and really was enamored of her work. And so she writes with a very sort of gothic quality, where with just a few strokes of her pen, she's able to create these very strong, evocative images of history and place. And so I thought, gosh, this tale needs that sort of gothic quality that Rebecca has in her writing. So, you know, I called her and I said, Rebecca, you know, I've got this story and it's not really necessarily in my wheelhouse completely. It somewhat is, but somewhat not. And, you know, I was wondering, you know, if I envision it being a trilogy, would you want to, you know, write that with me? And she goes, well, what's it about? I said, it's about vampires. She goes, no, not at all. I don't want to write about vampires. But then I laid out sort of the history behind it and the intriguing basis upon my sort of concept for this. She goes, oh, that is cool. And so that was, well, let's do that. That's for the other part of the book. I'm going to do something cooperatively with a good friend of mine. And so that was the inciting factor for writing that. And another time I thought, gosh, you know, I grew up reading these Danny Dunn scientific mysteries growing up that were geared for middle school. You know, it'd be sort of fun to do a non-magical middle school book where, you know, Danny Dunn didn't have any special powers. He was just a smart kid, you know, trying to get out of jams by the seat of his pants, and I didn't want to create a character that was like that. So that was the Jake Ransom series that I began with, a middle school series featuring a boy who's the son of 2 archaeologists who vanish into Mexico, and he's going to get into these big archaeological adventures, and he has no special powers besides being well-read and quick-witted.
Interesting. Yeah, I had forgotten about those. When you brought that up, I remember when you started them, and then it's kind of a thing you hear about, and then you forget. But I think I really like the Sigma Force novels. Am I bad for just liking them right now? I haven't read any of those series.
No, not at all. I mean, like I said, at this point, that is my bread and butter. That's every year you get by, you know, I do the Sigma novel, and the other book is just something to keep me fresh. I don't want to, you know, my feeling is by doing that other book, it helps me keep my Sigma books fresher. Whereas if I think maybe if I was doing Sigma after Sigma after Sigma right in a row, I might get stale. I might get tired of having that same characters. But it's nice to go somewhere else for a while so that when I return to that cast of characters, like you mentioned before, it's like coming home again. It's like visiting friends and families that you've missed for a little bit. So you're ready to get into a new adventure with them.
Is it hard to keep them all straight? Do you sometimes get them mixed up? I mean, there's a lot of stuff to when you have like these three different series. Is that difficult?
The only time I've ran into that problem is when I've tried to write books concurrently. Usually that doesn't work for me. I get very immersed in my story when I'm writing. I'm living those characters. I'm living that story. I'm dreaming about what's happening in that. I'm jotting notes when I wake up. So I'm in that world. And at one point in my career, I tried to do 2 books at the same time, where I do like a couple chapters in this book, and then I switch around to a couple chapters in that book, and then go back. And that was like stripping gears in my head. I just couldn't do it. It slowed my pace way down because of having to sort of, you know, reacquaint myself with the story every time I switched back. So to me, you know, I'm pretty much a one book at a time type of guy. That would do you know, two books a year.
Well, what's been the reaction to the Rebecca Cantrell series overall?
It's been really good. I mean, again, a little surprising. Some people have raised an eyebrow about James Rollins writing a vampiric type of series of stories. But those that have read it, you know, people said, gosh, you know, I don't really like vampire stories, but, you know, I sort of trusted you. So I read it. My gosh, I actually like them better than the Sigma books. Thanks.
Really?
So it's been very well received for those that have read it.
Well, now I'll have to read the first one to see how that is. It's interesting when you see authors. What's that?
I hope you do.
Yeah, definitely. I remember seeing them. I just haven't had a chance to read. I think, you know, I'm so picky sometimes. I want what I want. I want what I know in the past I've loved.
Right.
You know,
and there's so many books that come out. It's just so hard. I mean, I'm oftentimes my stack of to be read book always grows faster than my read book pile.
Do you read a lot of books?
Oh, I read constantly. I mean, to me, you know, people ask, what's the best advice you can give to a new writer or a writer that wants to get published? I tell them, you know, the old adage, you should be writing every day, which is definitely true. There's a rule of thumb, you should expect to write a million words before you expect to be published. So you need to get that million words under your belt. You need to get practice your prose, you need to practice your writing. But I always add the caveat, you know, besides writing every day, you should be reading every night. Because whatever problem you have during your writing day, whether it's, you know, describing a character or doing dialogue, it forms a knot in your head. And as you're reading at night, it's going to start untying that knot. You're going to see by example, you know, how to address that problem you're struggling with during the day. And so I think if you're writing every day and reading every night, you can get stronger and stronger. And I still keep a notebook on my bedside table, so when I'm reading at night, I'll see a tool that I've never seen a writer use before, and I'll jot a note, or I'll find, you know, something, the way that this guy's introduced a character that I've never seen done before. I'll jot a note about it, and I'll try to incorporate those tools into my writerly toolbox. So to me, I still love to read, because not only do I enjoy it, but oftentimes I get inspiration and oftentimes tools of the craft.
You're good at talking to people too, I've noticed. I mean, just knowing you, I've seen you at book signings, and you're very easy to talk to, and you take things in. You're like a sponge. You take, when people talk to you, you seem that you're very relative to people. And a lot of authors aren't like that. There are authors that I've talked to that you can tell they're not really enjoying this interview, you know. As an interviewer, it's scary sometimes when you get, if you get in the middle of an interview and you know they're not enjoying it, you think, oh my God, how am I going to get through this? You know,
I found that, you know, I've written 33 novels, so I think part of that is the fact that, you know, I'm always, you know, back when I first started in the ancient, you know, times of the late 1990s, very few authors had websites, and, you know, I had a website, and then social media arose, and, you know, I remember talking to my publishing house and said, hey, there's this new thing called Facebook. You know, I think it's a good way for me to connect to my readers, but I'm not 100% sure how to do that. I was wondering if you can give me any guidance and, you know, on this whole Facebook stuff. And their response was, and I still have this response, it's a letter from them, was, oh, don't bother with that. It's a waste of time. Just write me another novel. And I thought, well, I'm going to ignore that. I'm going to, and I was like one of the first authors on Facebook. I still have a huge Facebook following because I like having that interaction. I probably spend too much time on Facebook than I should, but it not only inspires me because I, you know, it's nice hearing people that are enjoying the novel. That keeps me focused on, this is my audience. This is who I want to make sure that I do you know, I do find a new action set piece because they're going to expect a new action set piece. But also, like I said before, somebody sent me a little piece of art that ended up being a cover piece. I've gotten ideas from people on Facebook or via email that I acknowledge my acknowledgement page, and I thank because they sent me tidbits that became stories. So my antenna is always up, and to me, you know, I'm only one person, and if I can, you know, borrow the expertise of the, you know, the force of that social media, great. I research a lot, but I prefer to call people. people, to be honest with you, and pick their brain in person, because oftentimes I'm thinking I'm looking for a certain fact, but when I'm in conversation with that person, oftentimes they will tell me something that I was never expecting that is a much more unique take on whatever it was that I was going to address. And to me, that's very exciting. And that's so to me, you got to be open, especially if you want to write a 34th book.
Exactly. I love the fact you have pictures in your book. it's so interesting when you're reading the story. I think it makes it more real when you have the pictures. You feel
because
like
I've always enjoyed it. You know, again, you know, I always tell people, you know, you should write what you love to read. You know, I've always liked stories that have had a little bit of, you know, diagrams or maps or pictures in them. But I actually sort of started about when I wrote Black Order. I had to explain quantum physics to the readers to be able to follow what was going to happen next. And so I didn't want people to feel lost. I wanted to make sure they understood it. And so my first go-around was like a 10-page discussion about quantum physics. And my editor goes, you know, while this is clear, it's too long. Your readers aren't going to tolerate 10 pages of quantum physics discussion. Is there any way to trim that down to 3 pages?
Whoa.
I thought, I don't know if I can do that when I get them to understand it. But then I got an idea of putting pictures in there. You know, pictures are worth 1,000 words. So if I put 3 pictures in there, that's like 3,000 words I can cut out. And it worked. By adding a few diagrams, I was able to get that, what, you know, the nuts and bolts so that I didn't need them to understand all the quantum physics, just one specific aspect. And so I was able to achieve that with a couple pictures and 3 pages of heated discussion.
Well, how do people react to the illustrations? What kind of reaction do you get to them?
Oh, I get very positive. I don't think I've ever got a negative reaction from including some illustrations in the books. So I think I will continue to do so. Plus, I like to do it. It's fun. It's fun for me, just as a distraction, as a way of breaking up a writing day, is to open up my Adobe Illustrator and work on something.
And do you actually draw yourself? Are you a good illustrator yourself?
I'm fairly decent. My maps at the front of the book are done by one of the members of my critique group, Steve Prey. Maps are a little hard for me to do well, but everything else in the book I pretty much do myself.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. I think, yeah, like I said, I think it adds to the story. I really do. Now, are you at this moment working on another Sigma Force novel? I'm hoping you're going to say yes, because I...
Oh, yeah, I'm 3/4 of the way down the next one.
Are you really? When can you reveal what it's about, or are you not allowed to?
Not completely. I'm a little close, you know, I hold it close to my chest a little bit, especially if it's not done. I always feel somewhat possessive because the story's not finished. Once I'm done, even if the book's not out, I have a tendency to overblab about it.
Right.
But this book deals with Pearl Harbor, and oddly enough, some ties that go all the way back to the Civil War from Pearl Harbor, and some intriguing things that occurred during the end of World War II. It's going to deal with some strange science, and this book is probably, in my opinion, one of the scariest I've ever written. I mean, I've gotten creeped out by some of the scenes I wrote for this next book. So,
really?
Hopefully my readers will have a similar reaction.
Now, will that be out in 2017 or 18, do you think?
End of next year. End of 2017.
Oh, wow. That's something to look forward to. That's the worst part when you read. I just finished an author's last book like a week or two ago, and I thought to myself, oh, God, I want another one in that series. And it's almost like you're... I don't want to compare it to drugs, really, but it's almost like that feeling you need more. And
right.
It's a good and a bad feeling at the same time, because you really want it now. You know, readers want what they want right this minute. You know, like, I remember when I worked at the bookstore, they come in, they say, did they have another book out yet? And I knew there wasn't one coming out for a while. It's sort of like, what do you tell the person? You
know? Right.
Because readers are very picky about what they read. And you have to know what they're going to like. And so what you want to do is find something else in the meantime, you know. But your books are so interesting that, you know, to find something else that's as interesting is going to be very hard.
Again, that's one of the reasons I at least like to write 2 books a year, so hopefully I can service that audience a little bit. You know, it might not be a Sigma novel, it'll be something that'll give you a little bit of James Rollins before the next big Sigma novel comes out.
All right, so let's talk about this
gap.
Right, exactly. Let's talk about the Seventh Plague. Where did this idea come from? How from idea to actually writing the book, where is the what's the gap in between?
It's I have a hard time defining that necessarily, because I've always got my antenna up for that next, idea, that historical mystery or that bit of science I'm going to cobble together and build that roller coaster between one to the other. And, it's almost like a jigsaw puzzle. I'll be looking for what piece is going to fit with what piece, and sometimes that, the puzzle never comes together. Other times it's almost like a snowball effect where, one piece fits another, 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 and all of a sudden I see a huge story and get excited about it. And that's the story I know to write. This story came about because, I had somewhere in my idea box a conversation I had with this Egyptologist, again, picking his brain, not really looking for a story, just curious, and he had offer sort of a different timeline to Egyptian history, one that supported a historical basis for the events that occurred in the Book of Exodus. And most archaeologists at that point were believing that the story of Moses and the plagues and the flight of the Israelites was more mythology or allegory or parable and not necessarily historical events, whereas he was turning this on its nose by finding a shift in Egyptian timeline to find a section of Egyptian history that supports that. And that was really intriguing for me. And then I started sort of paying attention to the new Zika virus plague that's been going on right now. And one that's always at the back of my mind is the fact that humankind has always been sort of beset by these, series of plagues, never seems to stop. Go back to the Black Plague of Europe, and then we've got the Spanish flu later on, and then we have the AIDS crisis, and then we have Ebola, and now we have Zika. And me being a veterinarian, I'm sort of, curious about the pathogenesis of that disease, the epidemiology. How did this one virus that was in a Ugandan monkey, the Zika virus, spread, around the globe? How come whatever fire breaks we put against trying to stop it never seemed to work? So I was intrigued by that. And so that got me thinking, what if, with plague on my mind, I sort of was sifting through my idea box and I came across these notes from this guy that supported the historical basis for the events in the Book of Exodus, along with sort of a rational or scientific explanation for the plagues that occurred in the past. And then that's where the connection began to build. And so can I connect one to the other? And lo and behold, it seems I was able to.
But you have to do that with every book. That must be difficult after a while. I mean, after 12 books, I guess coming up with an idea, but I mean, having these all these interconnecting things, how do you know what to interconnect?
It sounds like if you read the book, it sounds like, gosh, that's a lot to figure out, but it's something I just have to figure out once a year. I mean, yeah, I do 2 books a year, but nothing's quite as probably as convoluted as the Sigma novels. And to me it's fun. It's not like I do it in one fell swoop. It's every month pretty much I go through my tumble of ideas, sift through it, basically looking to cull things that no longer work. Either maybe historical mysteries have been solved or somebody, other authors already tackled that material, so I don't want to do it again, so I can toss it away. And then during the process of just sort of sifting through all that, things begin to click and the story begins to build, and I basically have a year in which to try to find pieces that are going to form that jigsaw puzzle so that I can start writing it.
Well, I kind of think there's not a lot of writers that write like you, that I can think of. I sort of think of you as sort of like Steve Berry's stuff. I mean, yours are a little bit similar, but he's quite different. His writing style is quite different, I think. But
We've done book signings, book talks together. The way we describe our comparison is that, he's got history and science, but he leans more towards the history. I've got history and science, but I lean more towards the science. We're different spectrums of commonality. But you're right. I mean, it's.
What do you say?
Early on in my career, it was challenging to figure out where to pigeonhole me. I was invited to New York. I think after Harper had published probably 10 of my novels, and I was sitting in the boardroom and never met everybody here. It's the first time I actually met my editor face to face. And there's the marketing department, the sales department, the paperback division, the hardback division. At the end of the table is the head of William Morrow. He leans on the table, looks across this long boardroom at me and goes, "Jim, we've published you for a while now, but we're still not 100% sure what you write." And, I'm sort of happy with that because, I like to write what I like to read. I read a wide gamut of different genres. I like mysteries, I like science fiction, I like fantasy, I like horror. And so you're going to see all of that in my in my stories, that's what I love to read. So I like to find some blend of those.
That's interesting. I mean, everything about your stories is interesting to me anyway. Now, the question is, how do you keep all your readers? I mean, nobody can say your books are ever boring, because they're never boring. There's always something going on. And when you have multiple things going on in every one of your books, and I think that makes them a lot more interesting too. I mean, rather than just have one story that you're telling. Sometimes one story can be a little boring.
Right. Yeah, I definitely think that it's fun to play not only across genres, but across, you know, different aspects of science, you know, maybe just, you know, dealing with biology, physics, and then throwing a little history. It's just, you know, trying to a nice blend of different you know, technical and historical pieces that I think help keeps the story fresh, helps it keep so that I can write 33 novels without feeling like I'm treading the same ground over again.
Exactly. Now, you also have personal stuff that's going on with some of your characters, and is it Painter's father that's been sick in this book?
That's actually a Graze.
Graze, okay.
And Graze and Pierce, he's the main character of the field team of Sigma operatives. And, you know, again, I don't think any author writes from a vacuum. We're always drawing a little bit from our personal lives or those around us. And, you know, I lost this book is dedicated to both my parents who died from complications from Alzheimer's. My dad passed away while I was writing this book.
Oh, sorry.
And, you know, once upon a time, you know, 12 books ago when Gray first appeared, you know, I gave Gray a father who was in the early stages of Alzheimer's. There were limited deficits, but definitely something not quite right, something, you know, beginning to go wrong with his father. And over the course of the 12 books, we've seen his father descend into the depths of the fog of his Alzheimer's. And again, I've paced similarly through my own life with my own father. And so, you know, I think it's, I don't know if I'm just working through something, but I think it's something that we all struggle with in life. You know, we're always struggling to balance our personal life and our professional life. You know, here's Gray trying to save the world. At the same time, you know, he's got this pull to deal with the more immediate concern about his father. And I think we all are struggling to balance our professional and personal lives. And so I think that's something that hopefully, you know, helps give a little more resonance to that character, a little more sympathy, a little more authenticity to that character.
Absolutely.
You know, it wasn't with any purpose that I thought I was going to be running this path parallel to my own life, but that's the way it ended up.
Well, I'm glad you're writing and keeping your mind must totally be going all the time, and that's a good thing. I mean, that's a good defense against Alzheimer's, having so much stuff. I mean, are you
trust me, with both side of my family, my mom and my dad, you know, I'm reading every article about Alzheimer's. I'm doing everything that I can to try to stave off a similar genetic predisposition.
So you really enjoy writing. It's not a chore. You seem to just really just take hold of it and really enjoy it. Has it always been like that for you?
It's always been that way. I mean, it's, you know, I started writing a little bit in college, but I never thought that was a career track. You know, I didn't want to be a veterinarian. And so once I got my adult hat on, you know, I put aside my writing, but, you know, I kept reading, which is like throwing gasoline on that desire. And eventually I just couldn't quite give it up and started writing again. And then one book became two became four. And all of a sudden now writing is my paycheck and veterinary medicine is just my hobby.
Right. Do you still practice veterinary medicine?
I just do some volunteer work. I work with a group that traps feral cats in the Sacramento Valley. And I spend one Sunday for about 8 hours spaying and neutering them. So it's all I now do with my veterinary degree is just remove genitalia. But it's a hobby. I've achieved my goal.
I'm glad I asked. I didn't know you were doing that, but that's. I'm wondering about the elephants in this book. Now, you're going to get a lot of questions about elephants. I mean, the elephants are featured quite wonderfully in this book, and I think to myself, are all these habits of elephants really real? Has this guy studied elephants this much that he knows?
You know, besides my veterinary background, I went down to the San Diego Zoo and I spoke to some of the animal handlers, the zoologists down there, who were dealing with the elephants there. And, you know, these are the creatures that have the largest brains of any land mammal. They have the same synapses and same number of synapses and neurons as we do. And they put that brain power to use. I mean, they're tool users, problem solvers. There's a lot of things that occur in this book that people are going to raise their eyebrows about, whether elephants would do that. But everything that occurs in this novel, as amazing as it may seem, is fully within the capabilities of elephants.
It's almost surreal. You're reading and you're thinking, my God, this seems so hard to believe that elephants would act like this. And I think, but right. There must be some kind of element of truth there. You wouldn't put it in the book.
Everything that occurs there is authentic.
You can't just, I mean, it is fiction. We know that. But still, fiction a lot of times is based on things that are real, or something real that's happened, or some kind of fact. People forget that. They think, well, it's fiction. I don't want to read it because it never really happened.
Right. Like,
I've always read fiction. I can't imagine not reading fiction. But I enjoy that part, too. I enjoy the historical stuff, finding things out. I mean, to want to know things, it's such an important part of reading. You want to just take everything in, you know, and learn things, learn about history, learn about different things. And I find that when I watch like Jeopardy, I know more because I've read so much. You know, it's such a wonderful feeling. Now, do you read a lot of fiction, or do you read more nonfiction than fiction?
I still, as for pleasure reading, it's all fiction. My nonfiction is generally specifically targeted towards research for, you know, some part of some story.
Mm-hmm.
But typically, it's more fiction.
So, who are your go-to authors that you read every book they write?
You know, in the past, it was, you know, Clive Cussler, Tim Clancy, Michael Crichton, who I'm so devastated who passed away way too young.
Yeah.
But again, I read Steve Barry, I read Brad Thor, I read a lot of David Morrell. A lot of my friends that are in the thriller market, but I also read other. I mean, Nevada Barr and Mysteries. I love the fact that she uses each different one of her series is set in a different national park, and the national park is almost a character in and of itself in those novels. Again, one book, one author who is underappreciated is Dan Simmons. He writes across a wide different gamut of genres, and no matter what he writes, he wins the awards in that genre. And he writes Hyperion, he wins a Hugo Award, he wins Song of Colley, he wins the Horror Award, he writes a Mystery, he wins an Edgar Award. So he's across the board, but boy, can that guy write.
I never ceases to amaze me at the amount of talent that's out there. And it's not always the best-selling writers that have all the talent. It's sometimes it's people you've never even heard of. You pick up a book, you start reading it. Before you know it, you're into it. And I had my friend tell me the other day, we were playing words with friends, and she says, I gotta read. Because I had recommended a book to her, and I thought, what a wonderful thing to have somebody tell you that they can't wait to get back to
a book.
That's
a good thing.
That you recommended to them, you know. And
well, speaking of needing to cut things short, you know, I actually have to run off because I'm doing a signing at Nellis Air Force Base.
You know, are you really?
An hour and a half, and so I need to hightail it out of here.
Right. Well, it's been so great to talk.
It just dawned on me because I just realized I got to get going.
Real life has to sometimes take over, but that's okay. Well, we've been talking to James Rollins, and his book, The Seventh Plague, is out now in hardcover and audio and ebook and everything. And it's been a treat to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much, David. I appreciate it.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.